You are listening to People's Republic. You can find more of our show, more news and analysis at people on Twitter and Facebook at People's Radio ATX. And you can also find us on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Stitcher, and wherever podcasts are podded. Stay tuned. This week, we are talking with Dr. Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, about his 2014 book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. Rather than begin the story of the American Revolution in the late 1700s, Dr. Horn examines the colonial history of a century earlier, asserting that the independence movement of the American colonies grew largely out of an attempt to preserve slavery for the white landowning ruling class. The result of American independence can thus be seen not as a major leap forward for democracy, but as a world historic defeat at the time for African and indigenous peoples. We are joined by Dr. Horn now to discuss his work. Thank you, Dr. Horn, for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Was that a fairly good assessment of the takeaways from the book, or is there anything there you would like to critique from that?
No, I think that there was a fair summary and assessment. Let me say that since that book was published in 2014, I published something that might be called a prequel to that book. I'm speaking of The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, Supremacy and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. And in that book, I take the story back to the early 1600s. So now we're almost 200 years before 1776. And in that book, what I basically suggest is that at the beginning of the 17th century, that is saying the early 1600s, England was a fringe player on the outskirts of Western Europe. All you have to do is look at your map and recognize that the rising power was Spain in the first place, which at that time was involved in a conflict with the Dutch, in which the Dutch, in a certain sense, emerged triumphant. But by the end of the 1600s, England was a major power on its way rather quickly to superpower status, a status that then, in a certain sense, was bestowed upon its revolting colonies in North America, now known as the United States of America, which has carried that status on into the 21st century, although there is evidence to suggest that that reigning superpower status may be coming to a lurching halt in the 21st century. In any way, the answer to the question as to how and why London was able to catapult itself into the front ranks was basically slavery. That is to say that London became a leader of the international African slave trade. It also became a leader in terms of dispossessing the indigenous population of North America in particular, and then selling that indigenous population into slavery, be it in the Caribbean or be it as far away as the slave markets of Ottoman Turkey or of East Africa. That is to say, you can find Native American DNA all over the world, not least because of the depredations committed by Englishmen. Now, the turning point in that story that's told in the predecessor volume, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, comes in 1655 when London administers a devastating blow to the Spanish Empire by ousting the Spanish from Jamaica, which simultaneously not only delivers a blow to the pretensions of Spain, but also opens up more land for settlers and also for enslaved Africans to produce sugar. Sugar, as you know, was not only a sweetener for tea and coffee, but was seen in some circles as a miracle drug, if not as a marker of sophistication. And so with the sugar boom, which was propelled by the forced labor of enslaved Africans, you saw not only money pouring into the coffers of London, but also you saw more Africans being enslaved, which simultaneously gave a boost, a turbocharged boost to the African slave trade. And from that point, you can see the takeoff of the African slave trade. By 1664, with the money developed from the sugar boom, London had been able to develop a stronger navy from which it was able to oust the Dutch from what is now New York City and a good deal of what are now the North Atlantic states of the United States of America. By 1672, London had organized the Royal African Company to systematize the African slave trade under the thumb of the monarch, and keep that thought firmly in mind because it will shortly change. By 1683, London had another advantage because the Ottoman Turks had been stopped at the gates of Vienna and seemed to be their inevitable sweep westward was halted, leading to a decline of that particular empire. Recall that in sailing southward to enchain and ensnare Africans from ports such as Liverpool and Bristol, Englishmen ran the risk of being enslaved themselves off the coast of North Africa, which was then ruled by the Ottoman Turks. But with the 1683 defeat, that became less likely, which gave another boost to the African slave trade. And then by 1688, you saw the so-called Glorious Revolution in London, in England, whereby the wings of the monarch were clipped, leading to the figurehead status that Queen Elizabeth now enjoys today. And not only that, but the monopoly that the monarch had over the slave trade dissolved, as the rising merchant class was able to elbow its way in to this lucrative trade, one of the most profitable enterprises known to humankind, where one can invest $1 and get $1,700 back. The deregulation of the African slave trade, leading to what I call free trade in Africans, then leads to a gigantic leap forward of the African slave trade. But the problem was is that these Africans were pouring into the Caribbean, Jamaica and Barbados in the first place, where they oftentimes outnumber the Europeans 9-1 and some precincts 20-1. And that leads to a great trek to the North American mainland, where it was felt that conditions were much more favorable for slavery and foiling slave revolts. South Carolina, organized fundamentally in 1670, was basically a colony of Barbados. But even arriving on the North American mainland did not prevent the Africans from rebelling. You had a major revolt in New York City in 1712, a major revolt in South Carolina in 1739, another revolt in New York City in 1741. And so finally, what happens, to bring us to the book that we started this conversation with, the Counter-Revolution of 1776, London decides to erode the potency of the European powers that had been aiding the Africans in rebelling against the Union Jack. I'm speaking of the Spanish in what used to be called Spanish Florida and the French in Quebec. That leads in 1756 to 1763, the so-called Seven Years' War, where Spain and France are defeated. A world historic defeat, I should also say, for Africans and the indigenous population, because what happens then is that London goes to the settlers in Virginia, in Massachusetts, in New York, etc., and saying that this war was fought for your benefit, and so therefore cough up some taxes to pay for this war. And of course, the settlers did not want to do that. And that leads the settlers, in fact, to cut a deal with the French and with the Spanish against London. And it was with that assistance that the 1776 war was launched that led to the formation of the United States of America. Now, a couple more details. One is that London also in 1763 had issued the Royal Proclamation, which had sought to restrain the settlers, led by real estate speculator number one, George Washington, from moving westward, seizing the land of the Native Americans, and then stocking that land with the free labor of enslaved Africans. George Washington and his comrades, fellow slave owners, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, et al., objected to the Royal Proclamation, just as they objected to Somerset's case in 1772, which abolished slavery in England. It was thought that that decision would leapfrog the Atlantic, thereby jeopardizing these massive fortunes in the bodies of enslaved Africans. And that leads to this so-called anti-colonial war of 1776, leading to formation of the United States of America. And then to go on, you know that by 1790, or the 1790s, the United States, the newly born country, had ousted the British from the leadership of the African slave trade, not least to Cuba, which was then a Spanish possession, and by the 1840s were controlling the African slave trade to the biggest market, which was Brazil. That's talked about in my book, The Deepest South, United States, Brazil, and the African Slave Trade. Just like the story of Cuba is talked about in my book, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba during slavery and Jim Crow. But the turning point in terms of the abolition of slavery, of course, was the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, talked about in my book, Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, the Origins of the Dominican Republic. The Haitian Revolution led to a general crisis of the entire slave system, which could only be resolved with its collapse. It forced London to move to end its relationship to the African slave trade by 1807, then nudged the United States to do the same by 1808, entered into a de facto alliance with the Haitians, which then put further pressure on the United States. In fact, when your own Texas seceded from Mexico in 1836, not least because Stephen F. Austin and Sam Houston and the boys wanted to foil Mexico's attempt to abolish slavery, which they did in the 1820s under the leadership of Vicente Guerrero, a leader of African descent in Mexico 180 years before the election of Barack Hussein Obama in 2008. Sam Houston and company revolted and seceded to set up another independent country, not unlike the United States in 1776, but couldn't withstand the pressure placed on it by London and by their Haitian comrades. And so by 1845, Texas crawled into the Union to get back up to foil Haiti and Britain. And of course, Texas is still part of the United States of America as we speak.
Before, when you've talked about the Confederate Rebellion, you've said that they believe themselves to be the true heirs to the U.S. project, to the United States, the those who most represent the kind of U.S. ideology. And I think you basically had kind of agreed with that in some sense, that that to the degree that there's a core U.S. ideology that that slave owning, that Confederacy would probably be it. Is that kind of correct or?
Sure. I mean, if you look at the current issue of the American Historical Review, which, as you know, is the leading historical journal in this country, you'll find a short piece that I wrote where I try to connect 1688, the so-called Glorious Revolution in England, which I suggest was animated by the desire of the merchants to elbow their way into the African slave trade, 1776, whereby I argue that that was driven by fear that the mother country, London, would abolish slavery, jeopardizing fortunes in African bodies. 1836, where I argue that Texas also seceded from Mexico, not least because of Mexico's turn towards abolition of the 1820s. And then 1861, when the so-called Confederate States of America, joined by Texas, then sought to secede from the United States. And the reason I argue in books whereby that latter secession did not succeed, unlike 1836, at least temporarily, and 1776, perhaps temporarily, was because the international situation had changed. That is to say that abolitionist Britain was feeling its oats. The United States, the Lincoln government, that is to say, was then aided by Haiti, which turned away Confederate ships from its ports. Unlike, for example, a Spanish Cuba. Cuba, of course, was a slave-owning society up until the 1880s. And that changed international situation helped to guarantee that the Confederate States of America, so-called, would go down in flames. I think the burden is upon those who disagree with me to explain how and why it is in 2018 you have this rather unfortunate chain of events involving black people, be it being shot by the police, Sandra Bland in Prairie View, or Philando Castile in Minnesota, or Eric Garner being strangled in Staten Island, or being turned away from Starbucks, or being, you know, a young black woman in her dorm in Yale, police being called on her to have her rousted, or in Oakland just a few weeks ago, a young woman defined as white trying to call the police on black people barbecuing in a public park. People need to try to explain the deeper explanation for this continuing persecution of black people in particular. And I think that it's not enough to just say racism, although racism is a factor, but other societies have racism but do not have as profound a persecution of black people as the United States of America. In fact, I did a book on Zimbabwe, formerly Rhodesia, some years ago. You may recall that from the 1890s up until 1965, or 1980 actually, Rhodesia was a settler colony. In fact, when the white minority regime seceded from London in 1965, they claimed they were walking in the footsteps of 1776. And there was only a European population of about 250,000 and an African population of about 8 million. So they were grossly outnumbered, not unlike the Caribbean. And yet, the Europeans in what was then Rhodesia used to shake their heads in wonderment at the United States and the epidemic of lynching. That is to say, hanging black people from trees without due process of law, saying, why do you have to reduce yourself to that level? They were asking themselves that question in the 1950s and in the 1940s, more specifically. And I think we should ask ourselves that question today. And sadly and unfortunately, many of our scholars have abdicated their responsibility, have refused to dig more deeply. And I think that that's one of the many reasons why we're now stuck with Agent Orange in the Oval Office, who bids fair to plunge this country into an unimaginable crisis and perhaps take the entire planet down with us.
So much of Donald Trump is not really that different than, I think, what we've seen. I have seen the argument made that essentially the reason so much of the U.S. ruling class, for instance, hates Donald Trump is not because of his racism, his bigotry, although those are things that exist with him, but in fact that he is simply not the most kind of fit to manage the affairs in common of the U.S. ruling class, or the bourgeoisie class. Wondering though what that says, because I feel like he represents in many ways a strain of settler colonialism that is in fact entirely in line with so much of the kind of rebellious and almost apocalyptic nature of a certain settler colonial mindset, that he represents you know, to me, so much of what the U.S. is founded on, so much of the very core ideology of the U.S. is Donald Trump. He's not something foreign to that.
I'm afraid to say that you're largely correct, and I congratulate you on the perceptiveness of your analysis. Donald J. Trump, as I suggest in my book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, in many ways represents the essence of settler colonialism. Not only Donald J. Trump personally, but the class forces that are lined up behind Donald J. Trump. Keep in mind that Donald J. Trump got 63 million votes. Keep in mind that he was supported by a cross-class coalition of those defined as white, not only billionaires like Robert Mercer, but those who are not billionaires, like, for example, in Dixie, where for about 50 to 60 years now in Mississippi and Alabama, through all times of changing times, you've had a Euro-American majority, sometimes voting 9-1, voting the same way, be it the white rich and the white poor. In 1991, in Louisiana, your neighboring state, David Duke, a Klansman and a Nazi, ran for governor on an explicitly racist platform and got 55% of the Euro-American vote. Only a massive turnout by black voters prevented a Nazi from taking office in 1991. And I think that those sorts of inconvenient truths oftentimes are very difficult for the U.S. left to deal with. The U.S. left oftentimes takes the position that they can't deal with inconvenient facts. What they'll say fundamentally is, I know what you're saying, is accurate in practice. The question is it accurate in theory? That is to say, they have a theory of the case which does not admit the possibility that a Donald J. Trump can get tens of millions of votes from mostly those defined as white, which is one of the reasons why, for example, with the whole Russiagate scandal, and by the way, I'm interested in following the money with regard to Michael Cohen getting paid off by Ukrainian billionaires and millionaires and perhaps passing on some of that money to Donald J. Trump. But at the end of the day, if you're taking the position that Russia put Donald Trump in office, which some of my friends on the left do, then how do you explain the fact that black women who also use the internet and Facebook and Twitter, they voted against Donald J. Trump 9-1? Nobody ever talks about that particular issue. That is to say, why were such a considerable sector of the electorate, particularly those defined as white, were so susceptible, allegedly, to the machinations, we are told, of Vladimir Putin? And so this kind of inadequate analyzing, totally unlike, by the way, your perceptive comments of a few moments ago, it's putting us all on the fast track to perilous endangerment.
I'd like to continue, though, on that thread of settler colonialism. So we had a couple questions from listeners. One of our listeners asked how you see different strands of settler colonialism reasserting itself in new ways in the 21st century, especially on the self-described left. A lot of American leftists bristle at the idea of the U.S. being a settler colonial project to this day, and many, including self-professed communists, rely on the U.S. Constitution for their basis of whether it's quote-unquote freedom of speech or some rely on the U.S. Constitution, the Second Amendment for gun rights or whatnot. Who do you see as kind of the current settlers in this day? What does the settler colonial project look like? What are some of the forces driving it? And who are the people upholding the new strains of settler colonialism?
Well, one of the more unfortunate aspects of the United States today is that, believe it or not, sometimes the liberals are to the left of radicals. I mean, that's mind-boggling and astonishing. I mean, for example, Michael Klarman, an endowed professor at Harvard Law School, has just published this book, The Framers' Coup, where he takes apart the U.S. Constitution, of course, pointing to its underlying rationale, which is protecting slavery and the slave trade and protecting the 1% of that era. And yet you have some of our friends on the left who consider themselves to be left to the left politically of Michael Klarman, an endowed chair at Harvard Law School, yet they defend the Constitution. Of course, they haven't done any research. I don't know where they get their ideas from. I guess it's just, pardon the expression, but I guess it's like religious belief. It's based on faith as opposed to research. And I said in my book on the apocalypse of settler colonialism, problem is that I have a book coming out on Southern Africa in the next few months, and it would be as if under apartheid, pre-1994 South Africa, you had those in the left in South Africa who said, well, the regime in Pretoria has done a fairly good job of meeting the needs of the white working class and the white middle class. And so Nelson Mandela, instead of leading an armed revolt against apartheid, needs to really just pay attention to the South African Constitution and let it work its magic. And if you look at the United States, obviously the United States, it was a settler colonial revolt, that is the formation of the United States, not unlike Rhodesia in 1965 or Algeria in the late 1950s. And the Constitution and the resultant regime was meant to prop up the interests of the Euro-American population. And one of the contributions, in quotes, of the United States was the acceleration, if not the creation, of this new identity politics of whiteness. That is to say, those who were warring on the shores of Europe, English versus Irish, English versus Scots, English versus Welsh, British versus German, German versus Pole, Pole versus Russian, Serb versus Croat, Greek versus Macedonian, Northern Italian versus Southern Italian, Protestant versus Catholic, sometimes Christian versus Jewish. All of a sudden, when they crossed the Atlantic, They assumed this new identity, this politicized identity of whiteness. And one of the reasons for that new identity politics was because this country, the United States, had a real problem dealing with rebellious and insurgent indigenous populations, and they needed a broader population base to subdue and subjugate those populations, whereby you had a so-called Bill of Rights that did not obviously apply to the Africans, it only applied to the so-called white minority, including a Second Amendment, which obviously did not apply to the Native Americans and the Africans. As a matter of fact, the whole project was to keep guns out of the hands of the Native Americans and the Africans, as represented, fast forward to 1967, when the Black Panther Party goes into the California state legislature armed, which was consonant with the law, which leads to even the National Rifle Association helping to endorse gun control to prevent that from happening. And then after the Black people are disarmed and crushed, then they go back to their status quo, which of course leads to the Santa Fe, Texas massacre just committed and perpetrated a few days ago. So once again, I think that some of our friends on the left, they really haven't been thinking things. I think that to a large extent, they've been ensnared by the magic of white supremacy. They haven't thought that deeply. They obviously haven't read that deeply. I mean, for example, if you look once again at some of the liberal writers, think of Alan Taylor of the University of Virginia and his book, American Revolutions, it's much more critical of the formation of the United States than many of these people to the left of this liberal is. I mean, I think that in some ways, our friends on the left remind me of biologists who are still using textbooks from the early 1950s and haven't caught up with the literature on DNA, which means that they're going to be misled and misleading at best.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of really great thoughts there. So I want to ask one more question, and that's you have at this point gone through so much of the history of the Americas. You've really put out a lot of good studies at this point. We're talking about a 2014 book just 4 years ago, and I believe you've published something like 7 books since then. I want to basically ask what sort of important connections, because you've drawn so many important connections between the struggles of oppressed peoples throughout the world and especially throughout the Americas. What sort of other recurring themes or surprising patterns have you recognized that might not be immediately apparent to those who have not kind of deeply studied this world history?
Well, I'll try to curb my tongue with this last question and not be so long-winded. To your listeners, I would make these points. One, I think that all of us have to be involved in study. We can't be like some of our friends on the left who feel that they know enough and therefore haven't kept up with what's going on, either domestically or globally. We have to be constant and perpetual students. And secondly, we have to be activists. We have to be constant and perpetual activists. We need to be going to meetings, organizing demonstrations, organizing tennis unions, students' unions, working class unions. We need to be perpetual students and perpetual activists. That's the lesson I would leave with you today.
Thank you very much. We have been talking with Dr. Gerald Horn, professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Houston, about his 2014 book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. His latest book, the last to come out, was The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. That's all we have for this week. You've been listening to People's Republic with Brian Griffith. You can find our show on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Stitcher by typing in People's Republic. Or you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at People's Radio ATX for more news and analysis. Thank you for listening as we report on the global struggle for social and economic justice. We are out of here.